I am joined today by Professor Sir David King, Director of the Smith School of Enterprise and the Environment at the University of Oxford. Sir King is also Director of Research in Physical Chemistry at the University of Cambridge, Director of the Collegio Carlo Alberto, and Chancellor of the University of Liverpool. Sir David is an eminent scientist. He held the post of Chief Scientific Advisor to the UK Government and Head of the Government Office for Science from 2000 to 2007. He raised the profile of the need for governments to act on climate change and was instrumental in creating the new 1 billion Energy Technologies Institute. He was born in South Africa and started his career at the University of Witwatersrand. He then moved to the UK and worked at Imperial College and the University of East Anglia before taking up the post of Brunner Professor of Physical Chemistry at the University of Liverpool in 1974. He went on to become 1920 Professor of Physical Chemistry at the University of Cambridge and later became Master of Downing College in 1995 and Head of the Chemistry Department in 1993 until 2000. During this time, Sir David, together with Gabor Sumajai and Gerhard Oertel, shaped the discipline of surface science and helped to explain the underlying principles of heterogeneous catalysis. In 2008, he co-authored a book called The Hot Topic. As director of the government's Foresight Programme, he created a horizon scanning process which advised government on a range of long-term issues from flooding to obesity. He also chaired the Global Science and Innovation Forum from its inception. King has published over 500 papers on his research in chemical physics and on science and policy, and has received numerous prizes, fellowships and honorary degrees. King was knighted in 2003 and in 2009 made a Chevalier of the Légion d'Honneur. Today he receives an honorary Doctor of Science at the University of Warwick. Sir David, a very warm welcome to the University of Warwick. We are delighted you could be here today. Congratulations on receiving your honorary degree. You already have many awards and honours. Can you tell me, please, what this particular award from Warwick means to you?
My first lecturing job, as you've just mentioned, was at the University of East Anglia, beginning in 1966. The new plate glass universities had just been established at that time, which is now 46 years ago, nearly half a century ago. And Warwick University was one of the prominent of these new plate glass universities. And at that time, I came over to Warwick University very frequently because a very close colleague in surface physics at the time was a man called Phil Woodruff, who became Professor of Physics here at Warwick. But he was then a young lecturer, as I was, at East Anglia. And the two institutions really developed in parallel, starting in the case of East Anglia out of the fens and here out of the grasslands of Warwickshire, these great institutions emerged. And we had this philosophy that we were going to do different, and I believe that philosophy still stands today. It's been absolutely fascinating to watch the development from the beginning to what are now very mature institutions. You have over 20,000 students here now. When I first joined the University of East Anglia, within 6 months, I knew by name every student. You know, there were so few students in that first year. I certainly knew all the staff for the first 3 or 4 years of the university. So there was something quite unique about each of these new universities, which was something to do with comradeship. There were much closer communities, this business of knowing everybody else. I knew people outside chemistry, outside physics, in economics, social sciences, philosophy, English literature, because we all mixed together. So there was much more a sense of an interdisciplinary space. Now, of course, as these institutions grow, you tend to lose that. But those of us who grew up in it never, ever left it.
Thank you. You were born in South Africa and started your academic career there before moving to the UK. What brought you over here?
I had an argument with the South African government, and they won. Essentially, back in 1963, I was a supporter of Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress, and the African National Congress had been banned in 1962. Madiba was arrested. The Rivonia trials had taken place, and I was picked up in 1963. My crime was that I had been writing letters to the press, the national press, and as a young PhD student, this was actually quite a thrill to get your stuff published by the national press. And so I was a very regular letter writer. The editor of the Rand Daily Mail became very well known because he was subsequently put under house arrest. Lawrence Gandar even used to call me up and say, David, we need a letter from you on this. But when I was arrested, all of these letters, it turns out, had been collected by the special branch. My interview, which took place on the 11th floor of the Grays building in Johannesburg, was the most threatening sort of situation that you can imagine. Before I was interviewed, it was already known that people spontaneously jumped out of the window from the 11th floor. There were many so-called suicides, and of course, as soon as you sit there, you know that actually it's not suicide that's a problem. It's the threat of these rather big people standing in front of you who are prepared to throw you out of the open window behind you. And by the end of the interview, I had negotiated 3 months to finish my PhD. The condition was that I mentioned the interview to nobody. I finished my PhD in 2 years and 6 months and handed it in and arrived in England, postdoc at Imperial College, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Your area of expertise is surface science. Can you explain what that is, please, and what areas you have worked on?
Basically, everything you see and touch is a surface, and you're touching a surface with a surface. And so surface science is the science of all of these surfaces. I couldn't study all surfaces, and so my work was essentially on metal surfaces. The applications are very, very widespread. Within the chemical industry, the biggest application is in heterogeneous catalysis. And the simplest way of explaining what that is that in the chemical industry, you want to convert one set of chemicals, the feedstock, into another set of chemicals, the product. Mm-hmm. So, for example, you're going to take hydrogen and nitrogen and turn it into ammonia and then make fertilizers from the ammonia. Most chemical processes need a solid surface to enable them to speed up, and that's the catalytic process. In Japanese, the word for catalyst is the same as the word for a marriage broker.
Uh-huh.
Right? So shokubai is a marriage broker or a catalyst, and so the marriage broker takes the two chemicals, introduces them to each other on the surface, the catalyst, and produces the product, the children, which are the product that you want to make.
You have had a very illustrious career, working first at the University of Liverpool in 1974 and later at the University of Cambridge. In 2000, you were appointed as Chief Scientific Advisor to the UK Government and Head of the Government Office for Science. How did you feel about taking up this post?
I didn't know what to feel because I hadn't operated with government. Effectively, when I left South Africa, I dropped out of the political scene. I sat on a beach thinking about the offer I'd been made, and it was like looking at a black box. I didn't know what I was stepping into. In the end, I took the job because I felt there was a real job to be done. This was a period when the BSE crisis had really caused a massive downturn in public faith in what science could do for government policy. And so the challenge for me in going into government was to try and turn that around and raise the public trust of science within government. And that became my mantra. And in fact, when I decided I would take the job, I set as my condition that every piece of advice I put into government that wasn't related to national security, I would, within 3 months, put into the public domain. And this was whether or not the advice had been taken. And that was quite tough for Tony Blair to take, but he accepted it because I explained that if I was going to get the public trust back, I would need to have the public understand that my advice was open and transparent and not done behind closed doors. And Blair accepted that. It wasn't always easy for him, but he accepted it.
While advising the government on a wide range of issues, from flooding to obesity, what role can universities play in this process?
University academics were absolutely key to that process. I set up this foresight process in which we picked on big programs of interest to government which had a long-term interest. Obesity, for example, is a very slowly developing problem for the United Kingdom population. And one of the outcomes from our obesity study demonstrates that. By 2050, under the current trends, we concluded more than 50% of the British population would be clinically obese. Now, how did we operate? We worked with, in that case, 110 of the country's leading experts within the field. And these would be experts drawn from the clinical field, but also drawn from sports, drawn from all spheres of activity that may influence the outcome. People who were teachers in schools, people who were nutritionists, and so on. And this was very much my plan, which was to use this amazing knowledge base that is developed in our universities to improve policy capability within government. In other words, I saw my office as a window between the university sector with its amazing understanding and governments. Because what I realized in my first year in government was that there was no understanding of this enormous knowledge base and how rapidly that knowledge base was moving. You have to draw in the experts from the university sector if you're going to give advice to governments on risk management and on managing opportunities for the future.
In 2004, you made headlines around the world when you said that climate change was the most severe problem we are facing today, more serious even than the threat of terrorism. Do you still stand by that statement?
Oh, yes. I was both hated and loved for that statement, probably in America in equal measures. I became the most blogged person for about 2 months in the world. And again, that was 50-50. I was Marmite, the Marmite man. And essentially, it caught everybody's attention because of 9/11 and the focus on terrorism. And frankly, that was deliberate on my part. What I wanted to point out was that in the summer of 2003, we had a very hot summer in Europe. It was an unusually hot summer event. But it was also hotter than ever on record in Central Europe before. And the net result was there was something like 30,000 fatalities. And the newspapers didn't pick this up as a disaster, essentially because it happened as a kind of slow burn over 2 months. These people were dying. It didn't happen as in a tsunami overnight and then it hits the headlines. I just wanted to say, there's an event which has been more serious than any terrorist event, take 9/11, in terms of the number of fatalities. And if we really want to tackle the problem of climate change, we need to tackle it with a greater degree of seriousness even than we were attaching to dealing with terrorism. I, by the way, was very firmly against the action in Iraq. I thought that was counterproductive. That was the point where I broke ranks with Tony Blair, and I still stand by that as well.
You published a book in 2008 called How to Tackle Global Warming and Still Keep the Lights On. What were some of the main arguments in your book?
Well, I think the main theme of the book is that by the end of the century, the situation for our children and grandchildren is going to be made extraordinarily difficult with a planet that would be much hotter and with rising sea levels threatening 80% of the world's coastline cities. So, and 80% of the world's cities are on coastlines, so that's 60% of the world's cities under threat. Now, that's a tremendous challenge to the future. And it seemed to me that what we need to do is approach this in a way that is positive, that this is the biggest challenge our civilization has ever had to face up to. But within the context of the challenge, it's also the biggest opportunity for invention, for new ways forward, for actually perhaps even changing our behavior systems, where we begin to realize that we have evolved on this planet along with other living matter, along with the geological strata, along with the oceans and the atmosphere. We have co-evolved with the ecosystems, and these ecosystems are perfect for us because we've evolved into them. There's no other planet that has exactly the right atmosphere for us to breathe, the right gravitational field for us to walk on. There's no other planet that delivers the right amount of green matter that can deliver what we need to eat. And for every first breath we take, we can thank the forests for producing the oxygen we need. For every second breath, we can thank the oceans for producing the rest of the oxygen that we need to breathe. All of it is there for us. It's high time we learned to appreciate that. Our behavior over the last century and a half has been to completely ignore the global commons and deal with it as if we could destroy it without destroying ourselves.
And do you think that society takes climate change any more seriously now than we did when you were writing your book?
So when I was in government, I would say the period 2002 to 2008, the Prime Minister sent me touring around the world. I must have given 200 lectures a year in different parts of the world, and so I put a lot of effort into that. I've talked to parliaments throughout the world, in Europe, in Australia, in Africa, in Asia, in America. And I think that we were very much getting the point across. We were beginning to move. However, and it's a very big however, the Bush administration had decided to set its face against this. My very first mission into the White House was at the behest of Tony Blair, and he asked me to go over and explain why the British government thought that Kyoto was not dead. And I'm quoting what Bush had said 2 months into his presidency, that Kyoto was dead. And I was told, and so I had to carry this message back to our Prime Minister, that if Europe was concerned about climate change, they should get on and reduce their emissions, but they should not expect the United States to do that because it would damage the US economy. And the US economy being damaged would take every other economy in the world down with it. So there was a clear threat with this message. Now, subsequently, the US and Britain went to war in Iraq. I have no doubt in my mind, and that is based on conversations in the White House and on Capitol Hill, that that was a war to secure a friendly regime in Iraq in order to secure oil supplies to the United States in particular. That war, it's estimated, has cost between $3 and $5 trillion. Now give me $3 to $5 trillion and I could have decoupled the entire American economy from oil dependence. They would have solved the problem and maybe wouldn't still be faced with the problems they're faced with now.
Finally, what one piece of advice would you give to your fellow graduates who are with you today in the ceremony?
I think my advice is aim high. Be aware of the fact that you do have limitations, but you can always learn. And I think all of us who are in the business of learning find that you're forever learning. Keep learning, keep moving as you move up in your career. Do aim high. Try to maintain something that I think is my single most precious possession, which is my integrity. Whatever you do, if as soon as you let your integrity slip, if you're dishonest in anything, in public in particular, that is your reputation that you've put on the line and you've lost. And without your reputation, you go nowhere. Now, that sounds a little bit too serious. I think I'm very, very keen to see that everyone contributes what they can, understands the business of respect for other people, respect for the environment, respect for the planet, and not to take themselves too seriously.
Well, thank you ever so much for talking to me today, Professor Sir David King.
Thank you.